Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to join our conversations on the Exchange, you're more than welcome to do so. Our phone number is here for your use, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, and by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We complain from time to time about oppression and the lack of democracy in our country, but when you stop to think about it, we have much less to complain about than people in some other countries. For example, Honduras in Central America. A coup took out the country's leaders 4 years ago. Life has been uneven, to put it mildly, for many residents of the country since that time, and that is part of the reason that American volunteers travel there on a regular basis to make sure that they are seeing to some of the needs for peace and justice that exist among members of the Honduran populace. That includes a team from the Peace and Justice Ministry from the Ashland First United Congregational Church of Christ. Did I get anything close to that, Lucy?
Almost.
All right.
That was very good.
Ashland First. Ashland First.
Congregational.
United Church of Christ. Okay, churches with long names and the missions they go on. It may take less time to explain the mission than the name of the church. So Lucy Edwards, you just heard the voice of, is the volunteer who helped set today's mission up. And the name may be familiar to longtime JPR listeners. Lucy is a former news director here at JPR. Good to have you back in a chair with a microphone in front of you.
Thank you so much.
It's nice to be here. Good to have you. Paula Soule is with us as well. She's the associate pastor at the Ashland First UCC. Good to have you, Paula.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Nice to be here.
And Jim Phillips is with us as well, also a volunteer. Mm-hmm. So tell us, Lucy, we'll start with you about the whole process and progress and what you're doing here, how it all got started.
Well, there are two things, I think. You know, one is the accompaniment work, which I've been doing for since 2010, so for 3.5 years. And the other is the delegation that came from we call it the Ashland UCC. It's a lot easier. It's the church on Siskiyou Boulevard for those in Ashland that has the peace in English and Arabic on it, so people call it the Peace Church, too. But my husband, Jim Phillips, and I have been traveling to Central America since the 1980s. And, in fact, we met in Honduras. And this is sort of a revisiting of that time. In 2010, a Jesuit priest was receiving death threats, and some friends from the 80s who we had worked with Witness for Peace called and asked if we might be available to accompany. Jim was teaching because he teaches here at SOU, and I was available. And so we met with Pam Shepherd, who is our minister at the UCC, and she said, "Who are you going with?" And I said, "I don't know. Are you available?" And she said yes. And so the two of us went down in May of 2010, and accompanied an adorable Jesuit priest named Padre Melo. He had been receiving very credible death threats in a country where he was overseeing a radio station. And in the month of March 2010, 10 journalists in the country had been killed. And so we went in May of that year and accompanied him. And then I've been back 11 times. I've had 11 trips total to Honduras since then, with what became PROA, the Honduras Accompaniment Project, in Spanish, Proyecto de Acompañamiento Internacional en Honduras.
PROAH.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I like it because it's not Concha, it's PROA. You mm-hmm. know, it sounds like it's for something. And it's an international team. There have been Canadian and European, mostly, volunteers. I'm the North American, you know, from the United States, who has come down. And part of this work, and I sort of dragged my church along, because it is hard work. It is odd work. There's a spiritual aspect to it for me. And it was great to have Pam on the first trip. And I found that this year I needed to drag my church along, and so Jim and I, and actually our son Noah, were in Honduras for, Noah was there for 5 weeks, Jim and I were there for 7 weeks, and the last 10 days of that, we brought down a group from the Ashland UCC, and also there was a person from Amnesty International locally.
Right. Paula, Lucy describes this as a dragging. I mean, was it dragging or just a gentle tug that got members of the church down there, you included?
It was a tug. It was also an invitation from Padre Melo, who had come to visit with us in the spring last year. And so many in our congregation got to know a little bit about him and got to know more about the struggles that his fellow Hondurans face. So it was also a response to his invitation for us to, for Lucy to bring along a delegation. So it just seemed the right thing to do. And Pam, I was more available to go than Pam was. So this time I got to accompany Lucy, and five other people from our church came as well, and a filmmaker as well. So it was not a dragging, but it was unnerving. It was scary to think about going, because it's a very dangerous country. It's become to be called the murder capital of the world.
So, Jim Phillips, pick it up there. Why the murder capital of the world? What is going on in Honduras that leads to things like death threats against men of the cloth and actual murders against journalists?
Well, Honduras has a number of, it's almost a perfect storm, actually. Honduras has a long history of inequality in terms of the use of the land. It's one of those typical Latin American situations, which is here for a long time, which is in which the people, or the majority of the people, do not have access to enough land. There are a small group of people who control much of the land, and foreign corporations especially. Honduras is the archetypal, known as the Banana Republic, and so we've had corporations and large landowners who control a large part of the land, and that's been going on for a while now. And so, but that's just as the base of what's going on. On top of that, we have narco trafficking, which has come in the last 10, 12 years or so, and corruption in the government and in the armed forces, military. The sale of arms is a high arms sale in the country, and basically a lack of opportunity for young people. So it's really a perfect storm, and there's more to say about this one.
All right, we'll get back to that on the other side of a break. We're talking to Jim Phillips, Paula Soul, and Lucy Edwards about the Peace and Justice Program at the Ashland UCC Church. That's all I'm going to call it for the rest of the program. And about their efforts to make sure that people in Honduras stay safe. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today to members of the Peace and Justice team from the Ashland First Congregational United Church of Christ, which generally just goes by the Ashland UCC Church. It's also involved with the organization called PROA, which it's the accompaniment project is the easy way to say it in English. Lucy Edwards, Paula Soul, and Jim Phillips are with us in the studio, and you can join this discussion on the exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, it's 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. Jim Phillips, I want to come back to you just to set the stage for us a bit. You were talking about the perfect storm of things that go on there, the land control from outside, narco trafficking, government corruption. It sounds like you name it. There are some issues going on in Honduras. Do these issues predate, though, the coup of 09?
Well, certainly the land and resource issues do. It's gotten a lot more intense since then because the current government that came in after the coup has been much more willing to give concessions to large mining operations, et cetera. So all over the country have huge mining operations which are now displacing communities violently in many cases. Some of the killings and murders that have occurred as a result of the displacement of local populations and, you know, peasant farmers and small groups by mining operations, by large landowners and that. We also have in Honduras a very thriving arms trade, which is controlled in, at least apparently in large part, by former military officers who bought up a lot of the, got control of a lot of the arms that were demilitarized, I guess that's the word, whatever.
The army let them go, basically, or yeah.
In throughout Central America during the 80s. At the end of the 80s, there were wars all over Central America. And some of those arms, when the groups demilitarized, those arms got into the hands of the Honduran military or senior officers, some of them who bought them up. And so there's an arms trade going on. But the other issue that's really serious in Honduras is the lack of any kind of opportunity for the majority of young people who are, if they aren't lucky enough to be able to get onto university or do something like that, their only real choices are to join the military or the police, which puts them in a whole other category because sometimes those are the same groups that perpetrate some of the crimes, or they immigrate, and or which is why we have a high degree of Hondurans trying to get into the United States right now. And the third possibility is that they join gangs, youth gangs, which is another problem in Honduras. So it is a perfect storm of, you know, the traditional problems.
Honduras resource rich? I mean, is it sort of like the situation in the Congo where there's lots of things that can be mined or taken out through forestry, extractive industries generally?
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, it started with the banana companies and the fruit companies, and now it's they have transferred over to African palm, which is what we get palm oil from. And if you go and buy crackers or something or, you know, baked goods, palm oil is in everything these days. And that's a thriving export industry. But the extractive industry has been there a long time. Honduras is very rich in gold, silver, iron ore, antimony, which I'm not sure what we use it for, but it's a lot of things.
Probably cell phones. Everything
yeah, all
into
kinds
cell phones,
of stuff, yeah. Like. Mm-hmm. And a number of other things. And now they've discovered apparently a quite credible discovery of a large reserve of oil off the coast of Honduras and Nicaragua. But the extractive industries, especially the mining, has been very destructive for communities in Honduras in recent years.
Is it very blatant? I mean, do you have mining companies that simply gather up their own military resources and force people off their land? Or is it done through some sort of, I mean, through the guise of eminent domain or something?
It's done in part through the private security guards that these companies have. And actually in Honduras today, there are private security companies. There are probably, I don't know the exact number, somewhere around 80,000.
80,000 armed men.
And so they
sort of as part of private security. And the thing that's interesting about that is that the retired military, the ones who bought up the weapons from wars in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Guatemala, very entrepreneurial. So they had the weapons trade. And then as insecurity increased in the 90s, they started security companies, private security companies. And so now they have 80,000 men, armed men, who are at the service of private enterprise in the country. And there are communities where armed men simply run the show, whether it's for narco trafficking or whether it's for the mining company or whether it's for the and in other areas it might be that the military and the police who support a dam project or something.
And the government is simply not big enough or strong enough to oppose these
people?
Well,
the government has really paved the way for this. This is the new government since the coup. And there was an election / selection process, and a new government came in November of 2010.
And the United States does recognize.
January of 2010, mm-hmm. And yes, the United States recognized that government. The United States supports the Honduran military and police with training, with equipment, and with funds, and those forces also are, it's sort of criminal organized crime.
So the Honduran government itself, really wants the mining operations. I mean, they obviously for them, it's a form of development that in their view brings in money to the country and all of that. But it's also very destructive to both the communities and to the environment. The environmental destruction in Honduras is another aspect of this. So it's not just the violence against people, it's also the destruction of large segments of the environment. And there are indigenous, the native people, it's about 10% of population in Honduras is indigenous, native Indian peoples who have been there since for thousands of years in some cases. And they're already at the front lines of trying to defend the environment in Honduras
because
today.
Because they're the ones out in the countryside.
They're the ones who see it the most.
The stuff is that people want.
Right. And so that's what they get. But, the government supports all of this, the mining and such, and because for them it means revenue and money and Honduras has had such a close relationship to the United States for so many years that the Honduran government and the U.S. government, work together in some of these things. It's our mining companies, United States, Italy, Canada, what have I missed, but three or four countries in particular. The Chinese are very much involved in Honduras, too. So
we got a great overview now of what the basic situation is in Honduras. When you're trying to work for peace and justice in a country that has clearly a lot of problems, you can't obviously embrace the whole country at once. So Lucy Edwards, how do you decide where to go and who to work with?
Well, again, I'm part of a small team, and I'm sort of the the commuter of the group, because usually the volunteers live in Tegucigalpa in a house, and then from there operate in the country.
Tegucigalpa, and the capital of Honduras.
That's correct, and I come and go. And, you know, which is why 11 trips over the 3-year period. And I'm usually there, you know, for a specific need. Sometimes it's to accompany Padre Melo in the north of the country. I have accompanied human rights lawyers to hearings. That's another group. There have probably been 30 or 40 lawyers and judges who have been murdered in the country in the past, since the coup. And so, you know, you go to hearings and you listen to cases and you accompany folks doing that. Sometimes it's, you know, a march or something like that, which is sort of my least favorite. I don't like, you know, big crowds and things like that. But I have...
Just in general or because it's Honduras,
well,
and the people have
you
guns?
Know, it's, you know, there was... After the coup, people took to the streets with hundreds of thousands of people. And... And I could hear this little voice in me saying, "You're going to Honduras," and I could hear my reply saying, "Like hell I am." You know, it just seemed like, you know, the Arab Spring. It's not my – I don't want to be in the midst of – because, you know, I don't know. There's something about a mob mentality, even though Hondurans have been incredibly peaceful in their resistance, and it is a nonviolent resistance to the coup and then to the corruption since. So I don't know. I forgot your question now, but
it was about how you choose where to go and where to do the work.
And that's really you know, selected by the team and our closest perhaps organization in the country is COFADE, which is the Committee of Families of the Disappeared and Detained in Honduras. And Jim and I have a relationship, a 30-year relationship with that organization when we were there in the 80s. When human rights abuses and disappearances began really in earnest. And now that situation has surfaced again and is perhaps worse than it was, that organization hosts PROA. And, yeah, so we accompany their lawyers to hearings often.
That must be a little scary at times. I mean, your company, I'm sure you're not carrying weapons yourself, or am I making too big an assumption here?
No, we absolutely are unarmed and a nonviolent project, and the people that we accompany are not armed. That's usually fun, you know, when but you have sort of these two levels going on. One is you're constantly doing a security assessment. You know, I know exactly how many people are on in the van that we're going in. And, you know, and I know the names of people to the degree that I can. And I'm constantly aware of where we are, of what milepost we are, if you will, you know, so that if something happens, I know how many people, you know, who they are and where we are. And I think, you know, part of that is my training I worked for the fire department for a while in the CERT program. And you get used to, you know, doing assessments. But you're with human beings, and they're funny, and they're fun, and they're doing very, very serious work, but they're also, you're developing relationships, which in some ways is one of the risks of the work, because I have people that I just really deeply care about. And, you know, right now they're approaching an election period in the country on the 24th.
Yeah, November 24th.
And the violence just increases, and the assassinations increase, and the profile of the people who are being assassinated are the profile of the people that are friends of mine. And so, yeah, that's sort of one of the risks. But that's not to say that I haven't been terrified in the country. I have. But it's sort of like more of a simmering underground terror that...
It's never quite overt in your case, you're saying.
Yeah, you know, that I... You know, that it was... You know, I loved having my church, for example, with me. I mean, that was the best. Those were the best 10 days because I could see Honduras through their eyes. Mm-hmm. And it was heartbreaking because it's a heartbreaking place. And it's a courageous place. And, you know, we were in situations that were kind of dicey, you know, at different times. And I was okay because we're all together. And I think that's how we are. It's like if, you know, if you're alone, then you're kind of thinking it's not okay. But I just hold that I'm never alone.
We're talking to travelers to Honduras. They are trying to help out people in the countryside who could use some support from outside the country, Honduras being a particularly difficult place, as you're hearing. Our guests are Lucy Edwards, Paula Soul, and Jim Phillips, and they are affiliated with the Ashland First Congregational United Church of Christ, or Ashland UCC, and the program is also affiliated with the Honduras Accompaniment Project. The Spanish acronym for that is PROA. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number is 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Email address, jx@jeffnet.org. I was waiting for, Lucy actually got there about the same time I wanted to, which was to talk about the idea of seeing Honduras from the eyes of somebody who has not been there a lot, which I gather you have not, Paula Soul.
No, this was my first time to go. And it's a beautiful country, tropical, and I'll just tell a little bit about the first community that we visited. I think that will answer your question and give you an idea. We went to visit a community called Rio Blanco, where there's a large hydroelectric dam being installed on their sacred river. And they live there. They're very poor, but they live in a sustainable way, as they have for generations.
And I'm guessing no fish ladders attached to the river?
What's that?
No fish passage at the river? At the
yeah,
dam?
Right. No, not okay. At this dam, no.
All right, so go ahead.
And when we arrived, the people have an encampment because for over 6 months they've been just showing up every day to protest nonviolently this invasion of their community. And they welcomed us, and we started to spend some time getting to know them a little bit. And that was really the intention of our trip, was to be in solidarity with people and to hear their stories, get to know them and learn about the complexity and the reality of their day-to-day life in resistance. So shortly after we got there, several armed police with large guns came and sort of surrounded us and approached us to see what we were doing there and let us know they were there to keep us safe. Which we had felt
you felt less
well,
safe,
I was safe yeah. More safe before they arrived, of course. And after a little while, we asked them to move along if they wouldn't mind, so that we could get to know the people we'd come to visit. So we spent several hours with them, and I was so moved by the people who, at one point in the day, they began to one by one stand and give testimony. And these are people who have never probably been to any kind of higher education, and they were amazing in their ability to articulate the reality of their struggle, their courage, and that they know that this land needs to be defended, that this is what, that it's their land. And so they talked about the ways that one man was killed there just a couple weeks before we arrived, or in July. Tomas Garcia was shot by the military while the people were just involved with the peaceful protest. And we met his son, Alan, who was also injured in that attack. So it was very moving because I think I was especially aware that they are doing this courageous thing on behalf of all of us who are much less courageous to stand up against the power of these large corporations that would, you know, take over our choices and our land and disempower us from living in a sustainable way. And so they were really inspiring for me to meet.
Jim Phillips, it sounds like it really is the power of money from the outside world here, exerting some muscle, and the people who are trying to fight them really have not only no money but no political power, and mm-hmm. at this point no land either, it sounds like.
They have, the land that Paula was referring to, Rio Blanco, that land is the land that belongs to the Lenca. Lenca people are related to the Mayan peoples of Guatemala. They're an indigenous group, and they've had that land for generations. And in some cases, some of this land, especially for the indigenous groups all over Honduras, some of it is land that was granted by treaty, that was reaffirmed. It's been there for many, many centuries, but it was reaffirmed by treaties going back almost to colonial times. So it's been reaffirmed officially and formally in law, but in practice, of course, it doesn't happen. And you're right that money does trump these things. And The money in this case is the money that comes through the building of this particular hydroelectric dam is just one of a number in this area. And the hydroelectric dams are there to generate electricity, of course, and the electricity would be used for the mining operations that are going on.
So it's all about development and growth. Yeah.
With very little regard for either the environment or for the people who live there. And it's not just the native people, it's others as well who are in the area. And but the people of Rio Blanco have received a lot of solidarity from other groups within Honduras, from environmental groups, from student groups, from human rights organizations all over Honduras. And when you go to, some of their leaders have been charged with crimes themselves. You know, it's really blaming the victim, because in some cases, when Tomas Garcia was killed, that was, they tried to blame the violence they claimed that was going on. The government tries to blame the indigenous leaders for that, Berto Cáceres and some others who have been leading the organization, blame those people for what's going on and charge them with things. So it's a perversion of justice that the victims get blamed for the crime.
Much more to talk about with the folks on the Honduras Accompaniment Project and the Peace and Justice Ministry at the Ashland UCC Church, which I guess is using church twice if you include the C. We'll come back and talk more with them and take your phone calls and emails as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, this is our final segment of the day. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the Witness and Justice, Justice and Witness Project at the Ashland UCC Church, which is a peace and justice project involving people in Honduras associated with the Honduras Accompaniment Project. It involves people traveling from Ashland to Honduras, in the case of Lucy Edwards, 11 times in the last couple of years, just to try to help people who are oppressed and in danger from expansionary economic activity and lack of government authority. Lucy Edwards and Jim Phillips are a married couple involved with the church. Lucy's a former JPR news director. Paula Soul is the associate pastor at the Ashland First Congregational United Church of Christ. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So some of the things you're seeking in the way of you're trying to bear witness here, but also try to keep people safe. When we talk about things like the murder of Tomas Garcia, are people ever prosecuted for what appeared to be the many killings that go on in Honduras?
Jim? I think the word that comes to mind is impunity. I mean, the country is completely in impunity. There are occasional cases that are high profile cases that are pursued, and then the rest remain in impunity.
So kind of like a show trial, like, getting one person on trial and they'll face that, but there's, five or six more.
Happens occasionally. And sometimes what happens is that if the military is involved, the junior officers or the soldiers might get implicated and might be charged with something. And these higher-ups who, the intellectual authors of the crime, as it were, don't suffer anything. Or what happens sometimes is that they will arrest people. What they did several years ago with the murder, about two, 3 years ago after the coup, the son of the chancellor of the university, the National University, her son was killed in Tegucigalpa, murdered rather brutally and with a friend of his one night. And it was clear, and there was evidence that the police had done the killing. She had been protesting against the government in her own way and trying to protect her students at the university from being harassed by the police, and so she was a bit of a target herself. But her son was murdered, and what happened was that several of the police were charged with it because the evidence was overwhelming. They were taken to the jail, but then they were released on their own recognizance, and of course they disappeared and were never found again. So you have things like this which happen regularly, that even if they do charge somebody, or especially if they're military or police, they're gone. It never comes to anything. I don't know the exact figures, but it's something like a very tiny percentage, like 2 or 3% of these crimes ever even get to the court system. And then if the judge, the judge can be threatened, and or the lawyer in the case, in this case, the case of the people at Rio Blanco, the lawyer who's defending the leaders, indigenous leaders in this, is a man who defends, who does, that's what he does. He defends these prominent Native human rights leaders, and he himself has now been charged with various things. You know, they put pressure on him, and he's been threatened. And so we're beginning to worry about him a little bit, too, and Victor Fernandez. And so this is the whole justice system is under pressure. If you're an honest judge or a courageous lawyer, you can be threatened with your life.
Or criminalized.
So
those are the two sort of themes. It's criminalize or kill those who are bringing those cases forward.
Criminalized because they're accused of some sort of
subversive
activity or something?
Yeah, they're accused of some other, I don't know exactly what they've accused Victor Fernandez of, but he is the attorney for three very prominent cases. And so they've accused him of some misdeed and, you know, so he has to defend himself as well as these others.
So are there successes you can point to through the many visits to Honduras? I mean, it seems like in some cases what your successes would be measured by are things that haven't happened, that people are still alive, that sort of thing. I mean, is this what you're left to consider as the successes of your missions?
It's hard to look at working in Honduras in terms of success or of what one can accomplish, because I really don't know if I'm accomplishing anything. I know I'm called to be there, which is kind of an odd thing to be, but there I am. And if I hadn't been called, then I wouldn't go. So it's not really the place for everyone. I do think that the more people that know about what's going on, the more people that I'm connected to an aide in Merkley's office. He's been very good on Honduras. And I do think that that kind of work does save lives. Our friend Berta Oliva from COFADE, from the Committee of Families Have Disappeared, has testified in Washington, as did Victor Fernandez. As they returned to the country, that was like 2 weeks ago, as they returned to the country, they're, you know, being denounced and threatened. Melo has come several times, Father Melo, and he has given testimony and then returned and been threatened. But we think that the profile of that there are people in the United States that care, people in Canada, people in Europe that care, people that are bringing up these things, that helps hopefully protect to some degree, or at least bring that case forward. We can't really protect anyone. Honduras is so crazy right now that anything can happen, and it is happening.
Particularly with Padre Melo, why does he get singled out for criticism? I mean, why does he get death threats?
I think because he's faithful.
he's the director of Radio Progreso, which is a major radio station in the northern part of the country, which has been the voice of people in a lot of ways. They do a lot of programming which is very critical of the government and of the violence going on, and they've denounced in a lot of these things we've been talking about here. And so they are a target for that, both he himself and his whole team at Radio Progreso, which is a very young group of people. They're basically young people who are very devoted to their country and to making it better. And so they are all threatened various times, and he's singled out for that, but also he directs another organization. It's a research team, research and development team, which goes out into which does a lot of social research and writes about it, and it's disseminated. And so they are a communication means for a lot of what's going on in the country, and they do projects in the countryside with communities where they, you know, they talk to people about their rights too. And so this is really why he's very prominent in this, and he travels around the country doing this sort of stuff. I did want to say that I think, to your other question, that what is positive about all of this? two areas that I find really useful, hopeful right now. One is, Lucy touched on it, one is the route that we're pursuing in the United States here. This is our work here, really is our own government and our own Congress, because a lot of the military aid and various things that we send down in terms of the anti-drug war, which we're fighting in Honduras now instead of here, and the military aid we give really goes into the hands of people sometimes who are actually perpetrating some of these violence. And so there's been a movement to get the Congress, our Congress, to to defund or at least to begin to investigate where that military aid goes exactly. And this is part of what Lucy's alluding to with Senator Merkley, with members of Congress. And so we've been working on that. And they have sent members of Congress have sent dear colleague letters to around and sent them to Secretary of State Clinton before and now to
Kerry.
To Kerry. Yeah. The other thing I find really useful is, or really helpful, is that to me this resistance in Honduras is not simply a negative thing. People are not just, you know, standing up against this horrible thing, but also really in the midst of it trying to build their future. And we went to, I've gone to a couple of places in Honduras, various places where I find people, you know, improving their community, developing new, very new, very interesting, very low technology, simple ways to farm without pesticides, without, you know, and just very, but beautiful practices, beautiful things which people are developing self-reliance and community. And to me, that's really the core of their resistance to this, is to not simply negate it, but to develop an alternative, a positive alternative for their future. And as long as they're doing that, it seems to me that's, you know, that's going to continue to be a useful thing.
Paula Soule, again, as the person who had gone to Honduras, was this your first trip there?
Yes.
All right. So what impressions were you left with when you departed the country? I mean, did you have a sense of hope that, yes, you were making a difference, that things were going to get better? Did you, you know, what were you, what was the final feeling you had when you left, or the mixture?
The mixture. Well, I felt like I had a new responsibility to get to work and to tell their stories and to advocate with our congressional people. One thing most people don't understand is that the School of America still operates and trains people from Latin America. Some of the worst human rights abusers have been trained at an American military school. So that's...
Is that in Fort Benning?
Yes,
right, Fort Benning, Georgia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That protest to close that school is coming up again in 2 weeks, the same weekend that elections will be taking place in Honduras.
Yes, next weekend.
Yeah. Next weekend, the 24th. Yeah. Thank you. We'll be telling several of our stories on Friday night at the church, and that event will be open to the community for people who'd like to come in here. It'll be at 7 o'clock at 717 Siskiyou. And,
at the church.
Okay. At the church.
Siskiyou Boulevard in Ashland. Okay.
True stories.
True stories about our experiences there. So I came away, sad for my for understanding better this, you know, the complex issues there. But they're not impossible to understand, and I think, you know, we all need to be paying more attention to our government's intervention in places like Honduras, and have a louder voice to demand better policies, better change. So we can be advocates. But I love the people that I met. I think I was very inspired by their courage, and I'm really committed to raising my voice and helping other people understand what's going on.
Lucy Edwards, do you have any illusions that the presidential election, is presidential and parliamentary, it's just a whole ball of wax on November 24th,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's
Do you have any sense that things might change for the better depending on the victory of one candidate or another, or is it a whole lot more complicated than that?
I think it's the latter. I think it's a whole lot more complicated than that because the way that the current government has set up, it doesn't matter who wins. There is the Congress will still maintain sort of this elite corrupt group, and they can do whatever they want in terms of the changes that they've made. The thing that happens in elections, though, is that everything is more precarious, and that's the concern right now. Is as it leads up and as it goes mm-hmm. out past elections.
Nasty campaign on a nasty
yeah.
aftermath based on the outcome.
Yeah.
All right. We have a call here I want to take from Michael in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the Justice and Witness Ministry of the UCC Ashland Church with Lucy Edwards, Paula Soule, and Jim Phillips.
Well, good morning, everybody. My heart goes out to you. We've heard this same information over the decades from writers like Michael Parente, Noam Chomsky, Naomi Klein, Philip Agee. We know. There's no question in anybody's mind who does research or even wants to listen that the United States is at the forefront of all these black ops, the disappearances and whole-scale murder of thousands. In Washington, it's like talking to I don't know, people in a glass cage. You can yell all you want, but they don't hear. I don't know how you're going to do it, but how far do you think you can really go trying to get Washington to pay any attention when they absolutely profit from all of this? How long is it going to be before you're declared terrorists, you know, in the pursuant of bringing any kind of peace to any country? I'll take my answer off the air, and thank you so much for your organization.
All right. Thanks for your call, Michael. Appreciate that. Jim Phillips, have you ever been called a terrorist for what you do?
No, I've been
called a communist.
I've been called a communist about 25 years ago, but since then, no. No, I. You know, we do. We are working with the Congress. I mean, a lot of people in this country are working with trying to get the Congress. And what has happened, of course, is there have been three letters, too, from the House of Representatives and at least one in the Senate, which have gone to the Secretary of State at various times. But the numbers of the signees of this have grown over the last couple of years. It is not an easy thing to do. It's very difficult to deal with Washington. And so, I mean, there's in this country, the two-sided thing that has to go on is, one, to deal with our own government. We can't avoid dealing with Washington because those are the guys that have the money that send it to countries like Honduras and that support these things. But we also are devising, you know, we do support the kind of solidarity work that we've been talking about and the many groups in this country that support that as well. So people who go directly to Honduras or support the Honduran people in various ways and bypass the government. What Padre Melo, Lucy was talking about earlier, one of his big points that he always talks about with North Americans is that our government, the U.S. government, should be talking to the people of Honduras rather than simply to the government of Honduras. We continue to talk to the same people all the time. So to try to get even our members of Congress and people to talk to, you know, to find new partners to talk to in Honduras would be a step forward.
Lucy Edwards, let me give you about 20 seconds. If you had unlimited funds, where would you put them?
Oh, I work on spirit and not so much on money. But I would give it to PROA. I would give it to the Hunter and Accompaniment Project so that they can continue to do their work in the country.
All right, you can hear more of these stories again on Friday night at 7 at the Ashland First UCC Church. That's at 717 Siskiyou Boulevard in Ashland between downtown and Southern Oregon University. I want to thank Lucy Edwards, Jim Phillips, and Paula Soul for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. And thank you for listening. Good to have you here. We'll talk to you again tomorrow on another edition of the Jefferson Exchange. Reed Newland, today's student assistant, Charlotte Duren, our producer. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Take care. Have a good day.